This is Continent of Media, number 0302. Just as I start recording, a train whistle goes by, something I cannot do on the World Radio Network. Continent of Media is produced exclusively for shortwave broadcasting on Radio for Peace International, and available on the web thanks to DXing.com, which is sponsored by Universal Radio, which offers quality amateur and shortwave radio equipment since 1942. For information or a catalog, call Universal toll-free at 1-800-431-3939 or visit them on the web at www.universal-radio.com. This edition of COM was recorded only slightly more than a month after the previous one. I hope I'll be able to keep it up this year, on February 22nd. Check our website, worldofradio.com, for summaries of this program and access to previous editions in audio. Continent of Media is about media around the American continent, not especially shortwave, a monthly supplement to our weekly World of Radio. Let's begin at the peripheries of the continent, at least politically, about Hawaii. KAIM on 870 was reported to have closed down a few months ago, but it is back. Brock Whaley sends a story from the Honolulu Star Bulletin of January 29th. It's back on the air, but very, very quietly. It was a 50,000-watt radio station. At that time, it was running a loop of praise music. While, says General Manager, we have a petition before the FCC to relocate over here on Oahu. It was based on the adjacent island of Molokai. The former Bible Broadcasting blowtorch was fired up to a barely audible 1,000 watts in November. Malevsky said it will remain there only for a season. It's not really for commercial purposes, just to keep the signal going. It's owned by the California-based Salem Communications Corporation. The plan is to relocate the transmitter to Salem's Tower in Kunia, Oahu, which also radiates signals of KHNR 650 and KHCM 940. Malevsky hopes to resume operation of the station on Oahu at 10,000 watts and believes federal approval will come within the next couple of months. He had not finalized the format, although Salem usually has something to do with religious broadcasting. The other stations, KGU 760, is from a different tower at Kiwalo Basin, while FM KIM 95.5 is in Palehua, home to the broadcast equipment of numerous other FM stations. Salem turned off KAIM on December 31, 2001. They wanted to eliminate the $12,000 to $13,000 monthly electric bill for the Molokai facility. KGU's electricity costs back on Oahu were only about $1,000 a month. Salem also wanted to boost its Los Angeles station on the same frequency, 870 KRLA, to 50 kilowatts, but there was concern the Hawaii and LA signals would interfere with each other. The Los Angeles population reached by KRLA clearly provided much greater revenue potential for Salem than Hawaii's KEIM audience. It was formerly owned by the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association, which boosted its power to spread the gospel to the islands of Hawaii and the Pacific, but sold to Salem in October of 1999. However, Graham still owns the Molokai Land and Transmitter Building. At the time the company announced plans to take the powerful AM off the air, then General Manager Doug Campbell said there were no plans to bring it back. We also have news of an upcoming additional Alaskan AM station, although at first it will just be relaying another one. On the Hardcore DX list, Bjarne Mjelde in Berlevåg, Arctic Norway, who bills himself as the world's northernmost DXer, says, "I got a friendly letter from KIAM in Nenana, Alaska, 630, signed by Chris Harper, program director. He said they're working on getting another station on the air in the area of Big Lake and Houston, if that's the way they pronounce it, KAGV 1110, with presumably 10 kilowatts, has a construction permit, and the town has okayed the antenna." That led Bruce Portzer in Washington to look around on the web and found that KIAM's parent organization has a page on its website for KAGV. It's www.vfcm.org/kagv.htm. As of November, they had bought the land, transmitter, and part of the tower, and they display a list of items they still need to get on the air, about $150,000 worth. Initially, there would just be a transmitter and satellite downlink with local studio later. They hope to have the transmitter site built this summer. And yes, of course, it is yet another missionary broadcaster. In his February Programming Matters column for Listening In of the Ontario DX Association, Fred Waterer has an article about the Inuktitut language, which is heard on the CBC Northern Quebec service 9625. In fact, it comes from CBC News that Nunavut is saying Inuktitut needs official language protection, just like French and English in Canada. Then he quotes an item from a website about the language, and we'll have a link to that if you want to read more. It says, to understand the nature of Inuktitut, the word needs to be built from its roots. Inuit refers to three or more Arctic Aboriginal persons, and an Inuk is one Inuit person. Consequently, Inuktitut roughly translates as in the way of an Inuk. Inuktitut is not just a language, it's a way of life. An Inuk not only speaks in Inuktitut, but he or she also acts, thinks, and lives in the way of an Inuk. As you can imagine, truly understanding Inuktitut might take non-Inuit a lifetime or more. Nevertheless, learning a few phrases can establish goodwill between visitors and Inuit, especially when dealing with a guide or others for several days. Pronunciation guides, Inuktitut could be called a vowel-based language, that is, every syllable ends in a vowel sound, unless there are two consecutive consonants. In this case, the syllables are split between the two consonants. For example, it's Inuktitut and not Inuktitut. An exception occurs in words like, I'll spell it P-A-N-G-N-I-R-T-U-Q, because in Inuktitut, N-G is a single consonant. The pronunciation is Pangnirtuk, which translates to place with mature male caribou. You should have noticed that the Inuktitut R and Q are not pronounced like the English letters. They are released in the throat, not from the mouth or lips, and are hard for an English tongue to master. Apparently these sounds are easier for francophones to handle. On the WTFDA list, Charles Gauthier in Saint-Lambert, Quebec, mentions an article found in La Presse of February 6, that's Montreal. There are too many radio frequencies on Mount Royal. The broadcast tower of Radio-Canada, which hosts most of the Montreal FM and TV transmitters, exceeds Health Canada norms on electromagnetic radio frequencies. Until a solution is found, the CBC has hired security guards to patrol Mount Royal Park and advise people to stay away from the tower site. According to Gilbert Paquin of Industry Canada, electromagnetic fields in the vicinity of the tower are too high. According to Security Code 6, which provides guidelines on human exposure, the overloading might be explained by the growing number of broadcasters using the tower and their increase of radiated power. In fact, that surely is the explanation. For example, 95.1 has increased power from 17 to 100 kilowatts almost 2 years ago. Health Canada also modified its application of the code after some related incident happened in the U.S. Charles Gauthier adds, there are 8 TV stations and about 15 FM using the Mount Royal Tower, plus a bunch of public services. The example of 95.1 reflects one of the stupidest decisions CBC has ever made, leaving the 690 and 940 AM to move to FM. 88.5 on the English side is doing so poorly as far as coverage that they've asked for a license to operate a low-power FM on 104.7 to serve certain neighborhoods that can't receive the signal on 88.5 at all. There were no problems of that nature when they used AM. This could be a blessing for the Xer if they implement what is said, decrease power, and find new transmitting sites in Montreal. The only AM station in North America that is broadcast station on 1610 remains CJWI, also in Montreal. There was for a while one in Texas, KALT Atlanta, but it went dark soon after it went on. And if you heard French-speaking programming on 1610, it's likely this, but the address has changed. Greg Myers in Florida reports to Hardcore DX that they have a new address and website. It's www.cpam-radiounion.com. Now that is not a call letters, it's an abbreviation for something else, CPAM, because the calls are CJWI, and their postal address is 3733 Jarry Est, that's JARYEST, deuxième étage, second floor, Montréal, Quebec. I'll pronounce the zip code in English, H1Z2G1. Looking for a job in broadcasting? How'd you like to head United Nations Radio? However, the qualifications are pretty stringent. The UN is seeking a high-level person to fill the post of Chief Television and Radio within the Department of Public Information. Applications are invited from senior broadcast executives and producers who could develop and implement a strategy to enhance coverage in the broadcast media worldwide of UN goals and activities. Candidates should have an accomplished track record in the news area, extensive knowledge of international broadcasting, strong leadership and managerial skills, intimate knowledge of new broadcast technology, at least 18 years high-level experience, university degree in communications or a related field. Full information is available from https, that means it's secure, /jobs.un.org. The closing date for applications is 23 March 2003. This was in the February Association for International Broadcasting newsletter. Since there's no shortwave, we tend to overlook Haiti, but the media there on FM or AM are in a very difficult situation. Radio Métropole in Haiti, for instance, reported on February 18th that because of threats and attacks to which the news staff has been subjected, they would observe news silence. That is a day of silence with regard to news as a protest. Since December 17th, 2001, several of our reporters in the provinces have had to leave the country in order to escape the threats of the Lavala People Organization. And I recall another report that they were being welcomed into the Dominican Republic for protection. And another station was also in the news. By the way, that report came via BBC Monitoring. The other one being Radio Haiti Inter. Michel Monta, an award-winning Haitian journalist and wife of the slain journalist Jean-Dominique, announced that she would stop broadcasting from her station, Radio Haiti Inter, because of the importance of protecting people's lives. An attempt was made on her life on Christmas Day when her bodyguard was shot dead outside her house. She continues to fight for justice for her husband, who was shot dead by an unnamed assailant outside the radio station on the 3rd of April, 2000. In her announcement, she said the directors of Radio Haiti are forced to make the difficult and provisional decision to turn off its transmitters. As of 22nd February, Radio Haiti will stop broadcasting temporarily because we believe it's of primary importance to protect people's lives. We are sure that Jean-Dominique would not hesitate to make such a decision. That was also monitored by BBC. Niels Jacobsen reports that on February 15th he's uploaded a new version, the third one, of his website El Dorado for LADXers. It began in 1995 and has become bigger and bigger, but he's made a new layout, which he hopes is user-friendly, more so than in the past. He says there are 1,248 verification signers, 908 email addresses, and 956 anniversaries, all from radio stations in Latin America. And he hopes to update it more often in the future and for support to his sponsors. Well, the site is rather complicated, and you, of course, can find it in the summary for this edition of Continent Media 0302 on our website. No www, just members01.CHEOO.SE/MWM/ELDORADO/index.html. Since Hector Garcia Bajorge became aware of the rather heavy interference his station in Mexico City, Radio Mil, is suffering on shortwave 6010, he has rescheduled the time of his DX program, Encuentro de X, to avoid the interference, namely from Colombia and from Sackville, doing digital tests of all things. The new times in Universal are as follows: Fridays at 23:25, Saturdays at 14:30, UT Sundays at 01:30, or is it 03:30? There's a contradiction there. Sunday's at 1500 and 2325, and UT Monday's at 0505, so he's avoiding the midnight to 05 UT period. Also, they have a new website, at least one page, on the Nucleo Radio Mil site. We'll include a link to that. We're in the midst of Continental Media 0302. Our address, P.O. Box 1684, ENID OK 73702 USA, or WORADIO at yahoo.com. In the WTFDA list, Steve Solomon from Cape Cod says, I'm just back from a trip from West Palm to Miami Beach, Florida. There were so many pirates on practically every open channel that it's truly difficult to determine the real stations from the pirates. He's speaking of the FM band. They must run several hundred watts or high antennas. They come in for miles and miles. Some are professional sounding and are in stereo. Others are terrible in mono with distorted or MP3 sounding audio. It's sick. Now is when we really need the FCC. This brought a rejoinder from D. Luke Steele. Yes, we need the FCC to protect the public interest in quality programming provided to us by corporate radio. Heaven forbid someone actually programs unique, independent radio to their community. This is America. Why should we act like we have a First Amendment? I'm not endorsing illegal activity, merely pointing out the hypocrisy of the FCC in regards to selling public airwaves far out of reach of normal Americans, who therefore have little chance to use the powerful tool of radio for good. Use it for profit all you want. Use it for creativity and public service at low power, and we'll SWAT team you. And another rejoinder from Kevin Redding in Arizona. He says, and rightfully so, the corporations paid a lot of money to make things go their way. We have great politicians because when you buy them, they stay bought. The FCC is totally and absolutely worthless. They're truly the most useless and vestigial organ of the government that ever existed. There was a long story in the Palm Beach Post of February 3rd, spotted by a number of our contributors. Mike Terry, Alan Pennington, Andy Sennett, Artie Bigley, and Terry Kruger at least. It's titled, Radio Stations Want Pirates to Sail Away, and goes into amazing detail about these FM pirates in South Florida giving call letters and frequencies as well. And apparently some of the legitimate South Florida broadcasters are having to take enforcement into their own hands since the FCC isn't doing much. Check that out in DX Listening Digest, number 3-019, or if it still works, follow the link in the summary. Another topic which comes up periodically is the plight of birds being killed by the increasing number of radio towers, especially when they're along their traditional migratory flight path. Terry Kruger sends a story from the St. Petersburg Times of February 14th by Craig Pittman that the FCC has been sued over birds killed by towers. Environmentalists say communications towers, not all broadcasting of course, kill millions of migratory birds a year, but the agency will not take action. So a trio of environmental organizations has sued the FCC. They want the FCC to stop new towers in a 100-mile-wide belt from the southern tip of Texas to Tampa Bay until the impact on the migratory bird population has been assessed and an effort made to halt or make up for the deaths. Every fall, 100 million birds from across the eastern U.S. migrate across the Gulf of Mexico in search of warmer weather in South America. Every spring they return, making a second arduous journey across the water. On both trips, they collide with nearly 6,000 communications towers that line the Gulf Coast. Attracted by a tower's flashing lights, the disoriented birds fly in circles until they smack into the tower, its guy wires, or the ground. One tower near Tallahassee has killed more than 44,000 birds. Gavin Shar of the American Bird Conservancy, which filed the lawsuit with Friends of the Earth and the Forest Conservation Council, said it's a wonder they get through it all. Nationwide, federal wildlife officials blame towers for killing at least 5 million birds a year, perhaps as many as 50 million. Studies have suggested that changing the light's colors or pattern of flashing might make the towers less likely to confuse birds, but no federal agency has mandated such a change. The towers are built with the permission of the FCC. Federal agencies are supposed to comply with the law requiring environmental impact statements, but the FCC says virtually all towers have no significant environmental effect. But the FCC is not totally idle. From Amateur Radio Newsline, this from the CGC communicator. The FCC has canceled an experimental license to a California company because it says it's being used for other purposes. According to the CGC communicator, the FCC canceled WC2XZV after Enforcement Bureau monitoring confirmed the operation. A letter dated January 17th, the commission said the station's emissions were not in compliance with the terms of its experimental radio license. But a story on recnet.com says a lot more, that there were published reports of an alleged pirate station operating in the Antelope Valley area prior to the experimental license grant. It was on 104.7, identifying as Frequency Radio, and with its website, www.1047.fm. A check on the website makes no mention of the experimental license or the FCC action to cancel it. We'll include a link to the FCC letter and more FCC news of actions or perhaps inactions. In the NRC AM list, Patrick Griffith in Colorado says, in looking through the FCC database, I noticed that they are still renewing the old remote pickup licenses within what is now the AM expanded band. For example, Garrison City Broadcasting has a license, KGZ975, on 1622 kHz in Dover, New Hampshire, for 30 watts AM. They've held this license since 1966 and last renewed it in 2000. It expires in 2006. It seems odd the station would renew it if they aren't using it, and it seems odd the FCC would allow them to. I also noticed that both Phillips and Shell hold licenses on 1614, 1628, 1652, 1676, and 1700 kHz. These are all for 50 watts, and they appear to be homing beacons. While the Shell licenses all specify offshore use, the Phillips licenses all specify continental U.S. Keep this in mind if you hear odd signals in between the expanded band stations. Mike Cooper forwards a column from Frank Ahrens in the Washington Post on February 6th. A member of the Federal Communications Commission says he'll hold additional public hearings on possible changes to the agency's rules on media ownership, saying that most Americans are not even aware that this is teed up for debate. It's Commissioner Michael J. Copps, who also called on the FCC to establish a procedure to accept anonymous testimony from media and entertainment industry employees fearful of losing their jobs if they testify against media consolidation. The FCC already has scheduled a public hearing about the media rules for February 27th in Richmond. He announced that additional unofficial hearings would be held in early March at the University of Washington in Seattle and later in the month at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. The FCC is re-examining its rules on media ownership as part of a regular congressionally mandated review. Among other things, current laws place a cap on the number of affiliate stations a television network can own. The issue of the hearings has produced something of a cold war between Copps and chairman of the FCC, Powell, who hopes to have a vote on any rule changes before summer. He said the FCC has received 13,000 comments from the public on media ownership, demonstrating that you don't need a 19th-century whistle-stop tour to hear from America. Media corporations are lobbying for the ownership rules to be lifted, saying that money-losing networks could benefit from buying additional television stations. On the other side are consumer groups, entertainment industry guilds, and unaligned members of the public, pressing to keep the ownership rules intact. They fear that lifting them would aid additional corporate consolidation and would diminish economic and creative opportunities for artists and create a sameness among media outlets, which I might add is already the case, but it could only get worse. Leah Brock-Whaley, we have a Variety story headlined Bush's Budget Backs Middle East TV Network. But also in the same story, there is something about CPB. President Bush recommended no increase in funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which distributes money to public radio and TV stations, and no special allocation of funds for the digital TV transition. Public broadcasters say the president's $380 million allocation actually represents a decrease, since he's suggesting the CPB use up to $100 million of the total funding for its digital transition. In each of the past couple of years, public broadcasters have received between $20 and $25 million, specifically for the digital conversion. Although many of them missed the initial deadline, there are more and more TV stations coming on with digital signals, all on different channels than their original analog. Of course, they'll be running both for a while. But now there are several on the low TV band, which should make for very interesting TV DXing once the sporadic E season gets going this summer. There was at least one station in Cleveland on the air last year. I don't believe anybody actually managed to DX it and identify it by sporadic E-skip. But it'll be interesting to see how well digital TV propagates. The signals will, of course, be bounced off the E-layer just like analog signals are. And there are a few DXers around the country who are capable of receiving digital TV, usually with a card in their computer rather than with a large high-definition monitor. In any event, in the WTFDA list, Matt Siddle in Nebraska compiled a list of stations known to be on the air in the low band, and there may be more by summer. On Channel 2, WKYC in Cleveland, WWMT in Grand Rapids, and KTVM in Butte, Montana. On Channel 3, WBBM in Chicago, Channel 4, WHP in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and WMAZ in Macon, Georgia. At least 7 skip targets to be looking out for, some of them quite promising, that is, free from nearby alternate signals, such as Macon, Butte, and Harrisburg. I might add that they're not necessarily running full power yet, nor are they necessarily full-time. If they are on, most likely during the prime-time hours at least. This commentary, dated January 25th, from Mike Cooper, appeared in DX Listening Digest. The recent massive outage shows the folly of international broadcasters' reliance on the Internet and faulty Microsoft product. Internet traffic was brought to a near standstill in the U.S. for a 15-hour period. Problems persisted days later in some parts of the world, and broadcasters think this method of delivery adequately replaces shortwave radio. Thanks to the Internet disruption, I was unable to access content from major Internet sources and service providers for many hours. Every page at RadioFrance.fr was completely 404. Forget listening to a webcast. And of course, if you can't get it on the Internet, you learn that the Internet has been rendered useless and you're wasting your time going there. The international broadcasters apparently think that what they have to offer is so trivially insignificant that we can do without it for 15 hours. Observers describe the Internet attack as the most damaging in a sesquiyear and warn it could have been a lot worse. Compare this transmission method, or business model, to shortwave radio. The Internet is clearly clumsy, imperfect, and unreliable. Using a bucket brigade chain instead of efficient electromagnetic transmission through thin air. What are the international broadcasters thinking? Are we supposed to move to Africa to listen to them, such as Deutsche Welle? Well, when it's working, I confess to doing a lot of Internet listening myself, nonetheless, as you might guess from checking my monitoring reminders calendar. Not that I can hear all of that by any means. Mike Terry forwards an AP story from Spokane, Washington, that on Monday mornings at 7:50 local time, that's 1550 UT, the station KPBX has a poetry segment by its own staff poet, Scott Poole, perhaps the only such position in American radio. Clear Channel gets an awful lot of bad press. So, in contrast, here's something great they've done for the betterment of humanity. From Yahoo Financial News via Patrick Griffith, the City of Pittsburgh and Clear Channel AdShell have unveiled Clear Channel AdShell's state-of-the-art automatic public toilet, or APT, in the city's south side at 18th Street and East Carson. It's part of Pittsburgh's coordinated street furniture program. You may read all about it at the link in this edition of Continental Media, number 0302. I'm Glenn Hauser.